When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition of Comic Book Podcast, where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs. We'll be discussing an infamous one today throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul. Hey, everybody. Welcome. Welcome all.
Welcome all to this wonderful thing that we do. Today on the program, we will be discussing one of the most f***ed up and bizarre things we've ever covered on this program. I'll probably bleep that. We'll be discussing The Shadow by Andy Helfer with art by Bill Sienkiewicz and Kyle Baker, which, boy, am I looking forward to this.
Well,
you just summed it up. But first, Brian and I decided we were just going to discuss a little bit about the new trend in comic books and the world in general, AI. So there have been some new AI comics, which is artificially intelligenced.
Sure.
It's
a brave new world, Paul.
It is a brave new world. So there are comic books being created by people, which the art is. So far, everything I've seen is that the art has been compiled by other AI-generated art with original stories over top. Are there AI-generated stories that you know of?
Yes, I believe there are also, you could do, so this is weird, right? I mean, it's not weird. AI has existed for a while. The concept of AI goes back to, maybe pulp novels in the early 20s?
Yeah.
But, right, so currently, ChatGP or whatever this is and various other things, the technology has reached a point where you can feed in, I want to create a story by, let's just pick a random author, I don't know why, but let's say Grant Morrison, and you could say, you could feed into, by the way, we're olds, so all of our young listeners can correct us on this.
Get off our lawn, by the way.
Get off our damn lawn. But you can feed in, whether it be art or story, into, you know, these programs that will then spit out a story in the style of, or art in the style of, fill in the blank.
Right. And it's also, you could say, I want my, you know, I want my character to look like such and so. Like, you pick a celebrity. I want it to look like, you know, Brie Larson. So I guess it's okay. I'm of two minds of this. One, the technology is fascinating. And
I think the technology is great. It's very interesting.
Yeah. I am. And from, you know, my real job is working with tech and building websites and things like that. So I'm really interested in what this can do.
Yeah.
Is it ethical? That's where my other mind comes in.
Well, and that's the tricky part. And there's also, I think, some concerns with replacement. So first of all, is it ethical to create a thing that is using previous work to make a thing that one is calling their own, except that it's not their own? It is using a program to use other people's work to make it their own. And we all have the argument, some of this is circular, I understand, but we all take influences, artists and writers take influences from other artists and writers and make a thing that is uniquely their own.
But, you know, I was thinking recently, sorry to cut you off there, but take something like Terry Gilliam's art. When he was with Monty Python, he took cutouts of other people's art and other people's photography. He cut them out and he animated them and made something completely new from it.
Right.
Now, this is a little bit different because he was using copyright-free stuff and royalty-free stuff. But that's kind of an analog version of AI, what he was doing. Mm-hmm. Taking other people's art, reworking it into something new. And it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. So I am fully on board with taking things and reworking them and making something new. However, the art you took it from needs to be credited and compensated. So you can't just take someone's art, and rework it without acknowledging that other artist,
right,
and saying, oh, and by the way, here's some money for me allowing me to do this.
Right. And my beloved wife passed me a note where she just wrote the word sampling.
Yes, that was
reference to music and hip hop and what have you. And, you know, I mean, it's a good sort of earlier reference to what's happening now, because I believe, and I've always believed, that sampling in music, particularly in hip hop music, is an art unto itself.
Right. And it can be done to various degrees. I mean, you could get samples by, say, you know, Public Enemy, and mm-hmm. it's brilliant. It's reworking, and it's just, you know, it's creating a new musical form. And then you get sampling from P. Diddy, which is just you play the song and go, uh-huh, over top of it.
Right.
That's well, not, you know.
There are levels, right? I mean,
right.
Public or De La Soul, the mighty De La Soul is currently in the news for one, a very sad reason, and one for a very great reason. And, you know, their catalog is finally being made available back into the public due to some copyright and various other issues. But, you know, De La Soul ran into a lot of problems early on with sampling.
Right.
Where, you know, they had to pay out to the creators of the original work.
And I believe rightfully so. I think all samples have to be, at least the original work has to be credited. And if you use, and again, I don't know the exact rules behind it, but if it's longer than a certain sample size, compensation has to be given.
Right. Well, I think you run into this here with like the podcast. If we used a song in the podcast, we can only use so many seconds of the song until we have to pay out to exactly. the writer of the song or to whoever gets money for the song. But I think also, and maybe here's where I run into problems, like Paul's Boutique.
Not my boutique, by the way.
Right, yeah. I think it took a long time for people to actually figure out all the samples on Paul's Boutique. At some point, you know, I mean, you could go broke. We're veering away from comics and into, I think, an area where I have spent a lot of my time before this podcast as a music writer and blogger or website runner, or whatever, where, you know, I mean, Bittersweet Sympathy by the Verve, let's take it out of hip hop, right? So the multi-billionaire artist, the Rolling Stones, made a ton of money on the Verve's Bittersweet Symphony, and the Verve made no money.
And they could have gotten around that by just simply saying, yes, we're going to use this song, crediting mm-hmm. the Stones and giving them a minor payout rather than a major payout. Same thing with not Alan Thicke, but the kid Thicke and Marvin Gaye.
Oh, right. Oh, the Blurred Lines song.
Blurred Lines, yeah. Which is problematic on many, many ways. But
many ways. I think
I think Kid Thicke is going to be my new stripper name, by the way.
I understand we veered into music, and that's a whole other conversation that a lot of really smart people are having this chat.
Yeah. Gee. Well, that just proves this is not a new problem. Right. AI is a new technology, but creators have been doing this for a long time.
Right.
And there are blurred lines. Where do we draw the line of, you know?
And AI is the new sampling.
Exactly. Yes.
The difference, I think, is that sampling done well is used to create a new song or a new piece where the previous existing music is used to create a newer, interesting.
You take different aspects of different songs and you Frankenstein them together into something that is right. unique and new.
And I think that doing that in the comic book form is interesting, except I don't think it's being done with the same creative lens. And I think it's not only lazy, but I think it has some ethical problems going forward because, say, major comic book companies, we're looking at you, Marvel and DC, decide that they don't need the artist anymore or the writer, and they can plug in AI art and start producing Batman or Spider-Man content, cutting out the writer or the physical artist and just plugging in. I think this is the concern, right?
Yes. And again, to move away from comics for just a minute, this is the CGI actor thing, mm-hmm. where if you have a model of Tom Cruise, you could conceivably make Tom Cruise movies for the next 100 years because you have every aspect of him and could create a digital model of this actor. But I don't think that's going to happen, because especially with the medium of comics, it's an interesting flirtation that's going on right now. But essentially what comic books are is art, and that comes from an individual creator or creators. You lose something, even if it's a painting or a comic book or something, the artist, there's something inherently beautiful about something created by a person that an AI cannot replicate.
But that is you and I talking.
Yeah, is it? This could be AI. You could be talking to an AI.
Suddenly there's going to be, there'll be the AI collected edition that our millions of listeners won't be able to tell the difference.
I did recently see The Guardian ran an article where there were three articles and one of them was AI generated. Could you pick out which one it was? Mm. And I couldn't. It all just looked the same to me.
Because the technology is just going to get better and better and better.
Well, we're going to see things like deepfakes that are going to be scary. Are what we're seeing real? We're headed into a Philip K. Dick universe, the Dickverse. this is what Philip K. Dick wrote about for years, which was just what is reality and who can we trust?
Does AI dream of deepfake Alan Moore?
That'd be an interesting comic right there.
But, you know, and I think this spreads outside of comics, because at the end of the day, I mean, we're covering what may or may not be a dying medium, and that's a different conversation.
Yeah.
You know, at some point, is everything we see, everything we experience being shot through an algorithm versus a human?
Are we in the Matrix is what creation. You're asking.
Are we in the Matrix?
Yes. Yes. Am I physically here or am I just in a virtual reality world? Yeah. I think I'm talking to Brian, but maybe it's just my own mind.
Right. Well, and we know right now that we're real humans talking, but we are also talking through a digital medium.
Exactly. You know.
And then you're going to go in and you're going to edit this and you're going to do it through computer programs. So what people are listening to currently is not actually us talking in real time. It is an edited and processed thing.
We're talking.
You're taking out all of my ums.
Yes. All our ums and lip smacks and, you know, and pauses and whatnot. That's all good. It sounds like we're talking in this really coherent way.
Right.
But in fact, it's actually 2 hours of nonsense.
Right. And then, you know, I say something really stupid and then I say, hey, Paul, can you edit that out? And you'll be like, sure, Brian. Or you'll be vengeful and be like, oh, no, I'm leaving that absolutely stupid thing you said in.
Oh, absolutely. I know you don't listen to this program, so I leave all your stupid bits in and make myself seem really intelligent.
for the record, folks, I've never actually listened to one of our podcasts.
Yes, it still amazes me. But you know what? We have nearly 100 episodes. We'll be coming up on 100 episodes very soon. Right. And that is more than enough samples of our voices that could be generated into saying anything you want. You could have me, you know, praising Hitler if you want to.
Right.
I just use the word Hitler. So that could be turned into something.
Right.
Yeah.
And suddenly we've got you as a neo-Nazi nut job.
You know, you could have me voting for Trump, which that's just, it's I don't want to get too far into the conspiracy theory side of things because the technology can be scary, but it's also really, truly amazing.
Some of it looks fun. And there's a couple websites that have shown, you know, someone doing AI generated stuff where you're kind of like, oh, that looks kind of fun.
Yeah. John Oliver did a whole bit on marrying a cabbage. He had people have, you know, have me marry a cabbage. And they came up with the funniest stuff. And it's yeah, that's hilarious. But
when it's used in instead of an actual creative endeavor, or when it takes a creative endeavor and claims it as its own, is where it starts to get tricky.
Yeah. I mean, making a meme and a little joke here and there, that's fine.
Yeah.
But when you take somebody else's art and then put it out as your own and make money off of it, that's unfair to the original creator. And that's where I kind of draw the line. All this other conspiracy and are we living in the Matrix stuff is fun to talk about. But honestly, and this has been something we've talked about on this program from the very first episode, which was creators need to be compensated. You know, this is hard work. You know, this is art, and art needs to be, you know, you need to be paid for your art.
And when you pay somebody minimum wage to click on a computer and generate a thing that is taken from somebody else's work who is not being compensated, that becomes tricky.
Exactly.
I don't think we gave any answers. I think we've raised questions, and I think it's an ongoing conversation.
Oh, this is something we're going to be talking about for years.
For decades, centuries, you know, well, if we're all still here.
We'll see. Well, our digital likenesses will still be here. Brian, we have nearly 100 episodes of this podcast. We're immortal.
We are.
So, AI, really cool, really scary.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. And thinking
we solved nothing on this.
No, but speaking of really cool and really scary, let's take a break and come back and talk about the shadow.
Ooh.
Need a podcast talking about weird stuff? Well, then we've got just the thing for you. Into the Weird, a podcast chronicling the madness and magnificence of the mighty Marvel Bronze Age of comics, featuring the voice talents of Mr. Billy Delicious.
Hola.
Mr. Herman Hellstrom Lowe.
Hey there.
And straight from the long box of darkness, his infernal majesty Dormammu.
How are you doing?
And many more. But wait a minute. You might be thinking, aren't all comics infused with a grain of weirdness? I mean, Reed Richards can stretch every single part of his body, right? And why did Ultron design the Vision with working genitalia? Well, you would be correct, but Into the Weird isn't just any regular comic book show, folks. We focus on the really bizarre. Here are a few examples.
A sword and sorcery barbarian grown spontaneously from a jar of peanut butter.
A duck running for president of the United States.
Benjamin Franklin playing hide the sausage with Doctor Strange's girlfriend, Clea.
A giant-sized man-thing lamenting the death of a clown.
A serial killer obsessed with killing only fools, dressed as cavalier with laser guns after witnessing a priest fornicating.
And so much more. So if you like the wonderful weirdness of the Bronze Age from 1970 to 1985, and characters such as Ghost Rider, Morbius, The Defenders, Man-Thing, Son of Satan, Skull the Slayer, Killraven, Howard the Duck, and the weird granddaddy of them all, Dr. Stephen Strange, then this is the show for you.
ITW's on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and TuneIn. Hit subscribe and join us for a comic-filled jaunt into the weird.
And we're back. Brian, this week was your suggestion, so you have only yourself to blame.
I do have only myself to blame.
Tell us about the shadow, please.
Oh, boy. In 1938, lysergic acid dielethamide was first synthesized by Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann. Many folks have enjoyed this creation over the decades. 38 years later, in 1974, noted musician Brian Eno released a song called The Seven Deadly Fins. It was very much a Brian Eno song. 54 years before this, in 1920, commercial radio began broadcasting to the general public. Radio proved to be extremely popular amongst the populace, with millions and millions of people tuning in daily for music programs, news, game shows, and audio dramas. It was a revelatory moment where folks from all over the country were brought together with a commonality not shared before. Families in Paducah could gather around the radio to listen to their favorite shows at the same time as families in Boston or Milwaukee or Cleveland. And advertisers lost their minds, realizing the ability to hawk their products to a teeming mass all at once in real time. Truly a golden age. The audio drama was one of the more popular aspects of early radio, from Little Orphan Annie to Nightbeat to Suspense to Orson Welles' infamous War of the Worlds and hundreds of others. One of the most influential was, of course, Detective Story Hour, which in 1930 featured a mysterious narrator who went by the name of The Shadow. The radio program was intended to coincide with the publication of the pulp detective story magazine, with his infamous tagline, "Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows." The Shadow became a hugely iconic character and soon had shows all his own, along with starring roles in the pulp magazines of the day. Since that time, The Shadow has been omnipresent in media, from the aforementioned radio and pulps to television, film, and comic books. His fictional history is complex, with varying origins and alter egos. He is a brutal man, and his war on crime is intensely violent, following a moral and ethic code that is strict and unwavering. With his wide-brimmed hat and black coat, he paints an ominous figure intended to strike fear in the hearts of evildoers. One could suggest he was influential on a certain Cape Crusader who was soon to follow. In 1973, DC Comics began publishing Shadow Comics and continued to do so intermittently until 1992. In 1987, Andrew Helfer, Bill Sienkiewicz, and Kyle Baker launched a new Shadow for DC that ran for 19 issues before being abruptly canceled mid-story. It is somewhat shocking the series lasted as long as it did, because it is a batshit crazy story. Dealing with a cast of hundreds and interweaving multiple storylines in each arc, the book is a kaleidoscope of outsized grotesquery, extreme violence, morbid humor, and psychedelic imagery. Helfer's plot is a Byzantine maze, scattershot, and potboiling, wherein the narrative is taken for a long drive, scenes crashing into seemingly unrelated scenes until spiraling into a strange cohesion. One can become confused easily, and this is an extremely wordy comic, though not in the Marvel method. The only moral center, the Shadow himself, is compromised by the utter amoral character of his agents and the severe immoral nature of his enemies. There are no heroes here, only the neo-fascist stringency of the titular hero. It's great stuff and great character building. No one individual repeats the personality or beat ticks of another. In a comic with such a large cast, this is a masterclass in character development, which is not to say everything works, because sometimes it doesn't. The true stars of this book are, of course, the mighty Bill Sienkiewicz and Kyle Baker. How they got Sienkiewicz to do the first arc, I will never know, but damn, you know the man, and you know what he's capable of. And he brings his A-game, as he always does. But it is Kyle Baker who takes over the comic after the first arc that really brings the utter absurdity into blurry focus. His exaggerated character and background work is a perfect match to the story, translating a fever dream to visual realization. This version of The Shadow is not for everyone. It is crude, violent, dense, and requires patience. But as an outlier of the work being done by the Big Two at the time, it is a fascinating and ultimately entertaining piece of work. It certainly pointed the way to Vertigo and Image, where it might have lasted a bit longer, at least past the Android Shadow bit that probably sent the book to cancellation bin. The creative team survived and thrived. I would have liked to see more, alas. I don't know if this is a good comic, but it is a hugely entertaining one, and dropping acid before reading would not hurt. So, Paul.
Byzantine maze. That is just the perfect way to describe this.
So I am on the hook for recommending this.
And I do like the fact that you're in the beginning of that intro, it was all over the place, much like this comic.
So obviously I recommended this. My memory of it was a little different than my reading of it. And I'm going to be honest right from the get-go. I don't know how to talk about this comic. I have like struggled. I think we will have lots to talk about, but my apologies from the get-go to the listeners.
There's a lot to talk about, but I don't think we'll be talking about story this time around. Right. And I just got to say, just to start off, you know, this is my first time reading this comic. So it was fascinating thing to have happen. The tone is all over the place. The plot is confusing. There's way too many characters. The message it's trying to convey is kind of muddled and contradictory. And yet it's really compelling. I was not bored. I'll give you that.
This is not a boring comic book.
And every single page, almost every panel, is like, I don't know how to feel about this. Am I offended? Do I love it? I have no clue. I don't know. But the first thing I want to start off with, and the thing we need to really discuss, is the Shadow's the villain, right?
Well,
I mean, he kills people, and he doesn't just kill them; he slaughters them.
Oh yeah,
and he loves it. He just laughs and has a grand old time just mowing people down.
There are so many great panels, like visually, like both from Sienkiewicz and Baker, of just him with his Uzis. not the Joker, ha ha ha, but the Shadows.
Yeah, and the words butta 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 of the Uzis going off is just a recurring theme.
Yeah.
But not only that, this is gets into my thing, he's the villain. He treats his team, he has this massive team of really questionably moral people.
I have two pages of dramatis personae.
Yeah, but he treats them with such disdain and disrespect.
Right.
And he puts them in danger without even a second glance. And he mind controls people, which mind control, that's serious supervillain shit right there. So the Shadow's the bad guy, I'm pretty sure. And of course, I'm being, you know, he's in the same vein as the Punisher of he's a bad guy, but he does it for the right reasons kind of thing.
Well, I don't think, I hinted at this, I don't think that the story really has a moral center.
Yeah. What is it trying to say exactly? I mean,
all of his agents, like most of the agents, and we'll get into some of those probably, but they're all compromised morally and ethically. I mean, he's pulling them out of the criminal element for the most part.
Yes. I mean, just the character of Twitchkovitz.
My favorite.
He's a drug addict who injects people willy-nilly with various drugs. And that's not what heroes do. Brian, what is this? Is it a parody? Is it a satire? Is it earnest in the message? Because the message is kill them all. Violent death is the only justice criminals deserve.
Yeah. I would not. I don't think that this is meant to be in earnest. There's absolutely no way reading this comic that there's any earnestness in it. Maybe the Herald goes to Washington one-off, which we could talk about.
We'll probably talk about that in detail
in a bit. Is the only sort of message aspect of this comic book.
Well, I don't know. I mean, this comic seems to hate corporate America. It hates religion, hates Reagan's America in particular, but it also seems to hate social services and welfare. It hates the poor. It hates drug addicts. It hates the rich. It hates everybody. Maybe that's it. It's almost nihilistic in its portrayal.
I think it is very nihilistic. I mean, at the very least, it's cynical.
It's very cynical. I mean, it basically depicts everything and everyone as debase and evil.
Right.
Yeah, it's a stunning piece of work.
I said in my intro, how did this last 19 issues?
Well, maybe it just confounded the editors. Like, what? I have no idea what's happening. And by the time they figured it out, 19 issues had gone past.
They had been like, well, Andy Helfer was an editor at DC.
Well, maybe that's it.
So he had friends in high places.
Or maybe he had friends who were high in places.
There's a reason I started out my intro with the invention of LSD.
Yes. I do like the fact that you weaved in the Brian Eno song. Very nice. You're not an Eno fan, as I know.
What? No, I'm an Eno fan.
Are you? I didn't think you liked the whole...
Brian Eno.
Proggy, rocky, experimental music. I didn't think you liked that.
You know, that's a different conversation.
No. Prog rock is glorious. It's one of the greatest musical feats of humankind.
Prog rock saying. Is garbage and goes on.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be doing a sub-podcast of Brian and Paul hate each other's taste in music.
We'll be doing a whole podcast on Yes.
Actually, it'll be a whole podcast just on one song.
And the podcast will take up less time than the actual song. Moving on.
Where would you like to begin, Ryan? How about this? Clones? Really? There's clones. It starts out with clones.
I mean, the first little bit of it, right? I have tried to like work on my memory stick in my head, remember every story beat without writing them down. And I have way too many pages of notes, so nobody wants to hear me shuffling through this. But it starts out right with clones. And so the issue is, without going too much into the history of the Shadow, so is it Lamont Cranston or, you know, is it Creston Mayrock? Is it, who is it?
Exactly, because he talks about himself in the third person a lot. Right. This Lamont Cranston left me a lot of money. It's like, well, you're Lamont Cranston, or are you not Lamont Cranston? His consciousness was placed in this new body. Yeah. Okay. So I told you this before we started recording, really big at the top of my notes. It says, this shit is confusing. Mm-hmm. And we've already started. It starts with, what the hell is going on? And I should say, I had, you know, as a bit of doing my due diligence and research, I listened to a lot of the old radio programs, which are available online now. And some of them are done by Orson Welles, and it's really, really good. That is not what we read.
No.
Not even close. This is ultra violent.
Well, and it should be noted, so this was late 80s. And so when, like you referenced the Reagan hatred, well, I mean, that's a common theme in art at that time. This is hard, really hard comic to discuss. As much as I actually really love it, yeah, for a lot of reasons that are hard to articulate, but then that's our job is to try to articulate it.
Or in some cases, just stumble for a while and then say, okay, everybody, we got to go.
Which might be what this is. So thank you to our millions of listeners for their patience.
Again, sorry to cut you off there, but
no, that's fine.
From the point of just sheer creativity, this is a cornucopia of ideas.
Right.
There are so many things happening. There are so many. Okay. Just the fact that there is a member of the Shadows team in an iron lung doing phone sex and serviced by monkeys. And that's not even a main character. That's just somebody who's a side character.
Right. This is Lorelei. And so she's one of the older agents, one of the pre-existing agents. And when you say serviced by monkeys, we should be clear that the monkeys are taking care of her.
They are her nurses, not her,
nurses,
not her, not her boyfriends.
But but also it's fantastic. It's this woman in an iron lung who is paying her bills by doing phone sex, but she's also ostensibly kind of coordinating the agents, right?
Yeah. She's sort of like the operator who can,
right.
You know, who's the central line where she gets everybody together, which is interesting. And the monkeys pay off at the end. The monkeys pay off at the end are words I said out loud.
Monkeys, chimps, and gorillas are a large part of this comic book.
Indeed. So as bizarre and weird and all over the place as these stories are, they do, like you said, they coalesce. They do kind of come together and you say, okay, so they did have a plan. This isn't just random shit being thrown at this paper.
So each... I initially advertised this as the all 19 issues. I scrapped the final story arc because I just didn't have time.
It's a lot.
And So we're dealing with the first two story arcs. The first one is Shadows and Light, and the second one is the Seven Deadly Fins. The Shadows and Light serves as an introduction to all of the agents. Like, we get Twitch, we get Gwen, we get Max, we get Harry Vincent, we get Margo, we get Elton, we get DeWitt, we get Mavis, we get Roy Tam. It goes on.
And who are who are the sons?
Qing Yao and Su Tae.
Who have Chinese names, but they're from India?
Taiwan.
Taiwan, okay. I thought, because they mention India a lot.
Yeah, the sons are the Shadow Sons. We don't know anything about there is progeny. We don't know anything about their mother. But, you know, they're just wacky characters who are teenagers in America and want to form a band. And they do form a band.
Yeah. Yes, they're kind of like Milli Vanilli.
Right.
And if you don't know who Milli Vanilli is, just it's okay. It's fine. You don't need to know.
It has a lot to do with AI, though.
Milli Vanilli is the AI of pop bands. Sorry, I find that really funny.
So the first arc is, like, we get the character building that Helfer does is fantastic. All of these characters have fascinating stories and have fascinating personalities. Like I said, he doesn't really repeat any character tics in this cast of a million.
He's a very good writer.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Again, I'm not really sure what his position on anything is.
Right. Well, it's comics. Does there need to be a position?
Yes. Storytelling takes a position. That's what it does. I know.
We'll leave that as I disagree. You know, I mean, like, just to give folks an idea, it's like, so there's Gwen, who's the 400-pound nurse who is also a professional wrestler. There's Harry Vincent, who is one of the older agents, and he is in a relationship with Margo, who is his long-suffering paramour, right? And so Harry wants to be a magician. There's Elton, who is a primary character. There's DeWitt, who is like this complete, he's like all the vices rolled into one.
When you start, okay, I open this up. I have not read this before. The story begins with Lamont Cranston, the Shadow, is dead.
Right.
And they're trying to recover his body. His team is trying to recover his body in order to place his consciousness in a new clone body. It's weird. But the way that it's framed, I thought Twitch was a bad guy because he's randomly injecting people with some drug to put him out. It's framed and told as if he's the villain who's trying to, you know, do something nefarious, but oh no, he's a good guy.
Well, he's one of the Shadow's agents.
And maybe that's it, that everyone is shadowy. No one's a good person in this.
Yeah, no. There's everybody's awful.
Yeah, everybody's awful. Everybody dies. And then the comic ends.
Except Percy Jennifer.
Except Percy Jennifer.
Who just wants to get paid.
Then there's some questionable Jamaican accents thrown in there as well. We should point out that there is a lot of humor in this. It is very funny at times. It's deliberately funny, but then there's sometimes like, is that meant to be funny?
And I think this is where Helfer works great with Sienkiewicz and Baker, is that a lot of the humor isn't even in the dialogue. With all due respect to the greatest master, Sienkiewicz, Baker does an even better job.
Really? I was going to... Okay, this might get into one of our first disputes.
Okay.
I love Sienkiewicz, and I thought his style really suited this. Because it's so chaotic, and it's right. And it's so, you know, it has that Ralph Steadman kind of drug-influenced look to it. It does seem like the first six issues seem like a complete acid trip to me.
Right.
You might be right in that Baker does better comedy beats. You might be right about that.
Both of them are two of my favorite artists. So
They're both outstanding. The art in this, regardless of what we say about the story, the art in this is stunningly good. It's funny. It's grotesque.
I think in the first story arc, Shadows and Light, it sets up a lot of stuff, right? I mean, like you said, it starts with clones, and The first story arc focuses primarily, there's like two kind of primary plot points. One is the light, the religious part of it. It's a sham, you know, evangelist preacher who is mind controlling a populace.
It's an obvious parody of Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and all that stuff.
You know, of TV evangelists.
Yes.
The other sort of main beat in the first arc is Shiwan Khan, who is one of the Shadow's old nemesis, who is returned, and he's the sort of Yellow Peril Fu Manchu avatar. I don't want to put it at the same sort of offensive level as, you know, Shang-Chi and, you know, actual the Fu Manchu, because I think they are creating him in a more interesting aspect.
I think, yes, I think the way, especially the way he's drawn and colored, mm-hmm. Is stereotypical, but I believe that's deliberate. It's supposed to be extreme and exaggerated to prove the point.
Right. I believe that this was intended to be. This whole comic is kind of farce. And so it's the Shadow meeting up with an old nemesis.
Well, it's just this old nemesis has seemingly gone legit and mm-hmm. is actually a humanitarian now, and actually does a nice little speech about how I can easily conquer the world through marketing rather than actually doing nefarious supervillain stuff.
He is doing nefarious supervillain stuff. Because
I was kind of disappointed by that. Like, oh, he kind of ruined it by making him an actual supervillain.
Yeah, I was kind of excited when he when we thought he was legit and that the Shadow was
the villain. The Shadow's the villain. I'm telling you.
But most of this first story arc is these plots are interweaved and some of the characters are interacting in both ways. It allows them to introduce us to like Albert Wren and Leonard and also Percy Jennifer and some other characters it brings in, establishing the large cast of characters.
Yes, the wild pack of nerds.
Yeah. The Shadow Net.
Is it a herd of nerds?
It's a herd of nerds. But it's also great, right? Because, I mean, this comic is referencing like a lot of like technology and early internet.
And it's fun to see that sort of thing back in the day.
Yeah. And it's kind of fun because it's very forward thinking in terms of it's actually using real things that are starting to become things.
Right. And even the Shadow, you know, he doesn't like the new technology. He prefers it when it was all analog and just phones. And he tries to get his people away from it. But it's interesting to see his team say, no, we need to embrace these computers. We can help. This will help us.
But it's also, you know, it's very establishing. I think the first arc is very establishing. Ideas that Helfer is taking further into the Seven Deadly Fins and trying to take it forward before cancellation. But you know, we also get Joe Cardona, the police detective, who was his foil.
Whom I kind of feel bad for, because he's not wrong.
No.
He's completely angry, and he flies off the handle, and he's not a very nice person. However, he's not wrong when he says, you know, the Shadow's terrible.
Right?
Yeah. And this is not how justice is served, by just shooting people down. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, and then, you know, it should be noted, it really plays up the Shadow's mind control, his power.
Right. Because he mind controls the detective Cardona constantly.
Yeah. And just people on the street, you don't see me.
We should note that, the violence is just out of control from the get-go.
Right at the beginning. I mean, he is not just killing people. Like I said, he's slaughtering them.
Now, they're all bad people, Paul, because the Shadow is determined that they're bad, and so the Shadow serves as judge, jury, and executioner.
And we're going to get to the questionable aspect of this in the next arc, with the prong killer.
Yeah. So I think you know, the first arc is it's massively entertaining if one has the stomach for it.
And if you don't like religion, this is the comic for you, because this comic doesn't like religion either.
No, not at all. The first arc is a lot of establishment. It also really sets the tone for one of my favorite concepts of the comic book, which is the Shadow's dialogue is hilarious. I mean, it's all internal monologues, right? And I mean, it takes the Dark Knight and moves it even further. Yeah. It's just the total self-involved seriousness of his dialogue constantly throughout the comic.
Sorry to jump ahead a little bit, but towards the end of the second arc, there's one little part where he's sitting alone in his room and he's monologuing about how, you know, it was better in the old days and the world is just getting worse. And he's just, and then I forget who it is, calls him. One of his team members Mavis. Calls him and she's Mavis. And she says, "Are you brooding again, sir?" Said, "Yes, I am." I laughed out loud when I read that. I was like, okay.
And I think Helfer is having a lot of fun with the Shadow's dialogue. It is a throwback to the sort of purple prose of the radio days and the pulps.
Yes, and I do like the way that the other characters react to him, too, because they're like, is this a test? What's going on? You know? Yeah, so like you said, I think the first arc is... We could have just focused on the Seven Deadly Fins, the second arc, because that is really a more solid story, although there's some weirdness. Without the first six issues, none of that would have made sense.
Right. And I think that the Seven Deadly Fins is sort of the... There are three separate story arcs. We're only talking about the first two. The third one could have been fascinating if it ever got finished.
Yeah.
But it's the Seven Deadly Fins that I felt was... like the strongest.
Right. And that seems to have gotten the most acclaim, I guess you'd call it, you'd say. It's what
I think so.
When people talk about this run, that's the story most people reference.
And that is when Kyle Baker steps in.
Yes. And like I said, I prefer Sienkiewicz, but Kyle Baker does an excellent job in the art in this.
Well, this, and I didn't mention this in my, but this is, this was Kyle Baker's first, it's not his first work. He was working at Marvel a little bit, doing one-offs and a few things. I think he did the Howard the Duck movie adaptation, and I think his first...
at least something good came out of that.
I think he did the Cowboy Wally show before this, but this, I believe, if I did my research correctly, was Baker's first sort of... ongoing regular sequential issue work, or okay. At least for the big two. So once the Shadows and Light story arc ends, we get a short one issue, we get a one-off in issue called Harold Goes to Washington. And this probably is the, we don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but it's probably the one serious issue of Helfer's run on the Shadow. In a nutshell, it involves an abused and bullied child who becomes radicalized and goes to Washington on a class field trip to meet the president, and he decides he's going to kill the president.
And become a hero,
and ends up facing not only the consequences of killing somebody, not the president, somebody else, but then... ends up dying like a child, ends up dying a really kind of awful death.
And not to keep hammering this home, this is why the Shadow is a villain. He watches a child die and is completely nonplussed by it. He's just sort of like, well, that's the fruit that the vine of crime yields.
Story, right. And the story deals with the kid is terrible.
Yeah, I mean, he ends up...
There is some strong, like, when we say Helfer, we're not sure what his social commentary is or what his intent is. In this one, it's pretty blatant.
I mean, this kid is terrible, but he's terrible for a reason, or terrible because people made him terrible.
And which doesn't excuse his actions, because he kills somebody else earlier.
Does that kid die?
Well, we don't know. It's never made clear, but we think he does.
If he dies... Why did they go on with the field trip?
Yeah, it's a weird moment. So, yeah. For those listening who haven't read it yet, everybody should read this comic. Everybody should read this. You owe it to yourselves, whether you like it or not is not the issue.
Like I said in the beginning, it's compelling. So
yeah, so at some point, he's being bullied by a kid. and the school bus is leaving. This isn't the field trip. It's before the field trip. It's just the bus going, taking the kids home from school one day. And he's being bullied by this kid, and this kid is wearing a cape. And so Harold locks the kid's cape in the window on the bus, and the bus takes off, and it appears that the kid gets strangled.
Yeah, he just kind of hung, basically.
Harold doesn't see this happen, right? He makes it happen, but he's not faced with the consequence of it that happens later in this issue.
The field trip is to go to Washington and see and meet the president, or hear a speech by the president.
Now, the reason this is relevant is that several of the cast of characters for The Shadow are in this, including Elton, who's a school teacher, and DeWitt is there, and Twitch is there.
And the kid, that kid is wearing a cape, who gets strangled, is he's telling the story of The Shadow.
Right, he's pretending to be The Shadow.
Shadow, right. There's reasons for all this. What there isn't a reason for is when Harold tries to escape, there's all kinds of miniature cities inside the White House.
It's a display, like, for the public, right? It's like a cities of the United States. I mean, we see this crap all the time, but it also works for the story purposes.
Yes. I know, I thought it was very bizarre myself, but...
At some point, like, Harold tries to shoot the president. He doesn't succeed. And so he makes a run through it, through this weird, like, cities of America display that's somewhere in the White House, and he's being chased by Secret Service agents. He ends up, he has a gun that was his father's. He shoots a Secret Service agent in the face. He has to see the actual consequences of his actions at that moment. You know, then he freaks out, loses his mind, keeps running, and eventually stumbles and falls. And he's wearing a cape. He falls and hanging himself on the Washington Monument, I believe.
A replica of the Washington Monument.
A replica of the Washington Monument. And throughout all this, the Shadow has arrived through reasons that don't really matter, but he's racing around too. So the Shadow's racing around, the Secret Service is racing around, Harold's racing around.
Well, there's an interesting bit when Harold is dead, the Shadow is standing there, and then his team comes in and they kind of look at him and say, "Really?" And he said, no, I didn't do this one. I mean, just the fact that they thought the Shadow killed Harold says a lot about him.
Automatically assumed, yeah. It's kind of a sad story. Now, there's a joke at the end with Twitch drugging all the kids on the bus. Now, not drugging, killing, just knocking them out. So
exactly. So they all sleep. Yeah. But it actually has a kind of 70s, like a Star Trek kind of ending where something terrible happens and then they all have a laugh.
Yeah. But it's the one where I think Helfer kind of gives, if folks are looking for anything redeeming in the story arc, because there's nothing redeeming in any of this otherwise.
No. It's interesting. It's an interesting one-off. Yeah.
I don't know if it's great writing. I don't really know. It's Marshall Rogers does the art, which Marshall Rogers is fantastic. It's an odd one-off that has a different tone slightly than the rest of the series.
And it's actually a coherent story told from beginning to end.
It has a beginning and end. And
there's a middle. And there's
an actual middle. Which leads us to the crowning achievement.
Yes, this thing. Holy cow. Before we begin, two words. Dick magnet.
And I didn't want to make the joke earlier during the dead kid part.
This is an actual private investigator named Richard Magnet, who calls himself Dick. He's Dick Magnet.
This isn't a mainstream DC comic. So the next story arc, again, the Seven Deadly Fins, which, of course, as we all know, the seven deadly sins, which are pride, greed, envy, lust, wrath, gluttony, and sloth. So the Seven Deadly Fins is a family of brothers.
The Fin family.
The Fin family. And there's seven of them.
Yes.
There's seven Fins.
And you can kind of map the deadly sins onto them?
So I tried to do this. I got caught up a little bit because I don't think it completely matches.
No. I mean,
some of them are obvious. Gluttony is obvious. Sloth is obvious. Lust is obvious. Anger is obvious. Yeah. Some of the others are not. There's clearly an attempt.
It's a little hand wavy.
Errol Finn, who is Sloth. We have Sean Finn, who's the drug dealer. We have Lonnie Finn, the pimp, or Lonigan Finn. We have Galen Finn, the hot dog king. We have Artemis Finn. We have Patrick Finn, and we have Archie Finn.
Archibald. Archie is sort of the de facto leader, I guess, of the Finns.
Well, Artemis, Artie, he's the one, he's the... Okay, so that's interesting that you bring it up, because Archie and Artie sometimes feel like they're interchangeable in terms of how their names are used. There is a little bit of naming confusion going on.
Yeah, I think ultimately it doesn't matter, because...
It doesn't.
It's chaotic to begin with, but...
Right. Because they all die at the end. Indeed. I'm giving a spoiler away.
But it begins with a serial killer who's on, you know, we get his first-person narrative about how he listens to a voice called Red.
And his name is Larry Gross. He's also known as the Prong Murderer.
Who, so this voice in his head tells him to kill people with a barbecue prong to the neck of his victims. And he ends up killing, which Finn? One of the Finns.
Well, it's Errol.
Errol Finn, that's right.
Errol Finn, well, he doesn't kill Errol Finn. He stabs him.
He stabs him and hospitalizes him.
Yes. But he's killed a bunch of other people before this who are all bad guys.
Right. So this is where what I alluded to in the beginning, where the questionable morality of the Shadow. The Shadow confronts Gross and is going to take him down. But Gross says, but you're Red. And you've been telling me that he holds out this list of all the people he's killed. The Shadow looks at it and says, okay, this is okay, and lets him go.
Right.
And it's at one point someone says, like, he's a, you know, psychotic murderer. And the Shadow's like, I don't know, I found him kind of interesting and compelling.
I found him charming.
Charming, that's the word he uses. Okay, so the Shadow identifies with a serial killer is, wow. I'm trying to come up with words that would describe how I'm feeling about that.
Well, but in this comic, I mean, the Shadow is a serial killer.
That's true.
He's just targeted in a way that, say, in Reagan's... See, this is the other part about all this, is this is Reagan's America. There are a lot of people reading this who are... Who's the... Is it Richard Speck? No, who's the subway vigilante?
Oh, yeah. What is that guy's name? I forget what his name is.
Right, but we know who he is. Right. So it's like, what's great about this in some ways is you do have to take the time into account. And this is the 87, 88, 89, somewhere around in there. In Reagan's America, where these sorts of ideas, this idea that a morally upstanding vigilante killing questionable individuals is not necessarily at this time in American history viewed as a bad thing.
No. And in fact, there was this notion of, you know, too much leeway has been given to, you know, too many rights have been given to the criminals and the victims are suffering. So more power has to be given to the police in order to just enact justice.
Right.
So someone going out and killing a criminal was seen as a heroic act, which will have no ramifications on the future and how we live our lives today.
But this starts off with the introduction of the Prong Killer, Larry Gross, and the Shadow being like, he seems all right with me. But through all of this, we're introduced to all of the Finn brothers, and there are, all seven of them are completely morally corrupt in seven different ways. So, you know, it's all, and Galen Finn.
He's the hot dog king?
He's the hot dog king.
Well, this is a very side thing that's a running gag, I guess, because people are killed in his hot dog factory and thrown into the hot dog mush to make hot dogs. But one person was killed and they forgot to take his diamond cufflinks off.
Right.
So someone, a random person, eats a hot dog and finds a diamond in it. So to get past the FDA's regulations, he says it's a a marketing ploy.
It's a promotion.
It's a promotion. You can find a diamond in your hot dog. And this takes a shot at the FDA. It's satirizing advertising and marketing. It's just gross.
It's just gross. But we forget, like, throughout the entire series, people have been eating his hot dogs. But this goes back even before the Seven Deadly Fins. People are eating these hot dogs.
Who's the big guy on Shadow's team?
DeWitt.
DeWitt. DeWitt eats like a whole package of the stuff. And he's like, ooh, I shouldn't have eaten that whole I shouldn't have eaten all those hot dogs. And then there's this little cub reporter that's been following them around who ends up getting very sick when he finds out what's in there.
Right. And this cub reporter is Patrick, it was Tome. His last name is Tome. It's Rupert Tome. And he's following Dick Magnet around.
I mean, it's not subtle, this naming convention, by the way.
We also have a lawyer named Hieronymus Bock.
Yes. Which has one of the funniest comedy bits, I think, because he's Hieronymus, known as Hi. So he walks hi, guy. Yes, that's a very funny scene. Every person he passes is hi, hi.
And his response is always like, hi, guy.
Yeah, hi, guy.
This whole story arc basically revolves around the Shadow taking down the Seven Dead, the Finn brothers.
The Shadow decides that he's going to take the Finn brothers down because they're a scourge upon the city.
Right. And there's shenanigans. There are so many shenanigans. We can't even hit all of the shenanigans. Eventually, the Shadow perseveres and everything is wrapped up. And, you know, each of the Finns die in ways that are apropos to the deadly sin that they are attached to.
You know, at one point, the Shadow takes these two low-ranking mobsters and gives them a box, which is a bomb, and says, you need to hand deliver this to one of the Finns.
Archie
Finn. You know, and you kind of follow them around for several issues. Right.
It's a lot of humorous bits where they're trying to, like, find the guy.
But eventually, it's kind of a suicide bombing where he kills two of the Finns. But the Shadow mind-controlled someone to do a suicide bombing.
Yeah. But, Paul, they're criminals.
Terrorism's okay if you're on the right side. What is this comic trying to say?
Then
there's that. One of the funniest bits, even though it does have questionable accented language, this Jamaican group, this Jamaican mob.
Right. Percy Jennifer and his Jamaican mob.
Yes. Has been following various Shadow.
It's a running cohorts. Gag throughout the first several issues, and it goes back to the previous story arc.
So Percy, his cab is commandeered and destroyed. So he seemingly wants to take his vengeance out on all the Shadow cohorts. But as it turns out, he just wants his bill paid so that he can fix his cab.
Right. But it's Percy Jennifer. I mean, it's a great running gag.
But then he ends up becoming a chauffeur of sorts.
Right. Yeah. So Percy Jennifer gets absorbed into the whole Shadows agents thing. I think this story arc is so dense in so many ways, and there's so many things that happen in it.
DeWitt finds Monkey Chow on one of the Finns.
Right.
Which leads him to investigate. So they track down who the trainer of the monkeys are, and it turns out he's only trained three people, one of which is the mom of the Finns.
He's also the man in the yellow hat.
Yes, he is. He's Curious George's dad.
Who may or may not be having some sort of...
How was that? They find him asleep in this
relationship with one of his monkeys.
Which leads to a showdown between the Shadow and a gorilla. The thing is, these are all just little things that crop up throughout the stories, but it does coalesce into, that had a point. There are no loose ends. All the threads get tied up at the end.
Right, but it's hard to keep track of those loose ends until they tie up, because once they tie up, you're like, oh yeah, I remember that from five issues ago.
Okay. Oh, that thing I thought was completely random actually had a point.
We could spend 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours on the Seven Deadly Fins going over every beat. There's so much, and there's so much satire. It's overwhelming, yet entertaining.
Right. It's convoluted, but in a good way.
Right. At the end of the story arc, the Shadow dies, and he dies from a convoluted, half-done plot involving some crazy, what was his name? Dr. Flax. There's this whole group of crazy people that get like swept into this by Artie Finn, a guy named Mustafa, who is trying to like destroy the United States. That's a little, there's some sketchy things there. But I'm also like
very much. It's very much the 80s.
It's very much the 80s.
And I think that's intentional, too. I mean, this is a satire. I mean, I was saying at the beginning, like, what is this? But it's obviously a satire. I don't know what it's satirizing or if it's satirizing everything.
I think it's satirizing everything.
Yeah.
And this Dr. Flax, he rotted out all his teeth so he could put in new teeth with some kind of poison in his teeth. And every time he needed to confront somebody, he would break one of his teeth and breathe on them.
Yeah, they put together this supervillain team from all the people that Hieronymus, his clients.
Representing.
Basically. Yeah, yeah. And you have like someone who thinks his hands are sentient, so he strangles people. And then one guy who thinks he's dead and wants everyone else to be dead. And then, of course, the prom killer. And then there's a little tiny mad bomber. Yeah, and it's very convoluted because Twitch ends up being the assistant for
Dr. Flax.
Dr. Flax. You know, the other serial killers want to kill Twitch. So Flax gives him a pill which simulates death. So he kind of saved him. So Twitch wants to save Flax, even though Flax is trying to kill the entire city. None of this makes sense.
Except at some point it does.
But we were talking before this started where, you know, this whole arc ends with this dramatic, the Shadow is dead. But it started with the Shadow being dead. And we know that he could be cloned and come back. It's not as dramatic. You keep using these words. I do not think they mean what you think they mean.
We're only scratching the surface, the kookiness in this. We haven't really talked about the agents in any way, in any serious way outside of maybe Twitch. There's so much.
And all credit to Andy Helfrich for, you know, like you said in the beginning, you know, creating these characters, and they are distinct. There's so many of them and they're all distinct and they all have kind of story arcs, and weaving all these plots and random things which do come together. So he has created this very intricate story, which does work and come together. And again, and Kyle Baker and Bill Sienkiewicz visualize that brilliantly. This works because of the art, I believe.
I think ultimately you're right.
In the hands of someone lesser, this would have been just a mess.
And one could say that it is a mess, but it's a glorious mess.
It is something unique. I have not experienced something like this before in comics. It's I honestly, when you recommended this, I was, oh, cool, I'll read The Shadow. I'm familiar with the 40s character. And then, I don't know, I just sat there every page going, what am I reading? What is this?
Yeah. I think it's a moment in comic book history. And it feels as if DC has kind of swept this under the rug a bit.
I think they swept it under the rug at the time.
And I think it's too bad, because I think this isn't near as kooky as some of the stuff. I'll tell you, Andy Helfer can write, you know, comics that don't take 5 minutes to read. My God, it's you read some stuff now and it's like, I spent $4 to have like a 3 minute read. It took me a long time to get through each issue.
Yeah, me too. So, I mean, if you think about recently, we did The Spectre,
right,
which has similar aspects, you know, the anti-hero and so forth. The Spectre was difficult, whereas this is difficult in a good way. The Spectre is difficult in a bad way, and they're not contemporaneous. I mean, they're close to each other, but I don't know. I didn't, even though the violence is bad and there's some questionable depictions, I didn't come away from this with a bad taste in my mouth.
I was highly amused. I think at the end of the day, I was highly amused.
Right. I think this, because it's coming at it from a humorous satire parody kind of thing. And a lot of the questionable depictions are done on purpose.
Part of the reason I like First LSD is because it's not just the art, it's the coloring. Whatever, I realize it was very 80s coloring. Coloring in the 80s was not fantastic, let's be honest. But this one is just, I was like, am I having a flashback?
And there's weird, you know.
Are there tracers? Am I seeing tracers right now? Because I'm like reading this going, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's a...
Some people will know what I...
No, I have no clue what you're talking about, Brad. No, I know what tracers are. I spent too many years going to Grateful Dead concerts. I know what you mean. Yeah. Overall, I think this was a very interesting comic. I enjoyed it. Is it a great comic? I don't know. Did I enjoy reading it? Yeah. Am I going to continue and ask questions and answer them myself? Of course I am. That's all I got.
I have probably another 2 or 3 hours worth, but I think I'm going to cut it off. There are many insane things that involving the Finn brothers, involving monkeys, there's just so much in this that cannot be covered.
Yes, it's a very dense
comic. In a coherent manner, because I'm not sure they're presented in a coherent manner, but it wraps up. And again, just watching Sienkiewicz and Kyle Baker have a blast with the art may be the best recommendation. Come for the art.
Yeah, even there's little chapter or, you know, the credits when they, they'll say, I've wrote a couple of them down, implemented with a measure of morbid curiosity by, brought to you under duress by, you know, a premeditated exercise in prevarication. You know, so they were fully on board with the this is crazy kind of thing. I'm glad you recommended this. I wasn't sure at first, but by the end, I was like, okay, I get this now.
This is a comic book that exists, and I'm very glad it does. So, Paul, this was me. So now it's you. You are responsible for the next piece of comic-related enjoyment. Would you like to tell us what we're reading next?
Yes, next time on an all-new edition of the Collected Edition. This is actually another convoluted story, but not nearly as bad. We're going to be reading Avengers Forever by Kurt Busiek and Carlos Pacheco. This is a 12-issue Avengers extravaganza filled with time travel and Kang. That's all I need to say. Yeah, so it's a 90s Avengers crossover event. I think we're going to cover all the crossover events of the Avengers eventually.
Maybe sometime, yeah.
So anyway, that's what we'll read next time, Avengers Forever. Thanks everyone for listening. Do read The Shadow. They're in nice Masterworks trades, which are
put out by Dynamite, I believe. It was DC, but I think Dynamite is now who has the license to The Shadow. So
yeah, they're nice additions. So check them out, and also give us your feedback on our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, and all the other information's in the end tag. Just listen to that, because I can't do endings. So anyway, until next time, keep reading comics
and be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @collectededpod. That's collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?